Thank you for those kind words, David. Let me wind the clock back roughly a year. And it's a delight to have Chris Skidmore here, who was minister at the time. And discussion was in the air of, you know, a lot of what ifs. What if this, what if that? The opinion at the time of the government expressed by Chris was that as Horizon Europe rolls out, the UK would like the option to associate, but there was a lot of uncertainty in the air and, of course, a lot of political dispute, and so wisely it was thought that we should explore in parallel with perhaps seeking the option to associate, what would be the what-ifs, what would be the alternatives in the event either that we chose not to associate or weren't able to associate. So Chris posed the question and commissioned a report that Graham and I did, which was ultimately called Changes and Choices, and we delivered that to Chris around about July, and it emerged into the public domain around November. Now, clearly, during that period and now, there are many shifting sands in political attitudes and debates. I think none of it makes the report any less relevant. So what I will do in my few minutes is really set the scene with some background things that we need to think about. In particular, for several decades, we've paid a subscription into the EU, and many of the processes and choices and decisions that followed thereafter took place, if you like, the other side of the wire. With Brexit, the financial contribution comes back over the wire and it becomes tensionable against any other public expenditure. So we're in slightly new territory that we are arguing for, in detail around things that we didn't argue in quite the same way previously. Now, I'll give you a load of facts and figures just to calibrate the stuff that comes next. So I will give some facts and figures. Graham will then say, where do we go from here? But it's worth noting in the beginning that if you look at the total percentage of research that's come from the EU programs against the total gross domestic investment in science, in research and development, then basically what's come out of the EU programs is about 3% of the total. And across the rest of Europe, it's not very different. And this diagram shows, you know, business, research councils, charities, the other ingredients that go into the total R&D spend. However, you might say, well, that's a tiny percent. What's all the fuss about? When you unpick it in terms of patterns of concentration, it perhaps has differential effects that we need to factor into the argument. If you take the Rossel Group universities, for example, roughly speaking, over the last few years, the income from European programs has probably been around 10, 11% of the total research income. If you combine it, as many regions and devolves in the UK did, with structural investment funds, Wales, for example, hugely dependent on a lot of these funds. And then if you look at individual disciplines, if you look at archaeology and classics and the use they've made of ERC and the rest of it, something like 30% of the total research income in those areas goes in. And of course, this masks the intangible benefits of people and networks and equipments and the rest that our German colleague referred to earlier. So beyond this then, we're looking at the world more generally, first look through academic spectacles and look at a metric, which is co-authored publications where there's a non-UK author. Actually, if you go across all things, and these are Elsevier figures, United States is by far the biggest cooperative partner, followed by Germany, France, Italy, and then we're into Australia and China. And the blue is a few years ago, and the black is more recently, and you can see the growth of the interaction with China, for example, there. So when we're looking around the world, who are the partners? What are the established relationships we have already? This is relevant, the R&D spend, to the targets that government has to get R&D expenditure nearer to 2.4% of GDP. If you look at the percentage of R&D expenditure in countries that comes from foreign investment, that's running at around 50% in the UK. So the UK is more dependent than most other members of the G7 on that inward foreign investment. If we try and unpick that, and you look at the country of ownership of the businesses that do that investment in the UK, and again, we look at it over time periods, the blue around 2007, the dark around 2017, UK company investment has hardly trended at all. American has gone up slightly, European gone up slightly, but the huge trend increase in that inward investment is from the rest of the world. And you can decide what the rest of the world is. It's an ONS categorization. It doesn't unpick it, but India, China, Japan, South Korea, etc. So those are some background facts and figures about the scale of the issues, what we do already in terms of global cooperations, how this fits potentially into the wider pattern of inward investments and diplomatic relationships and other things. And what Graham will do in the next stage is look at where do we go from here? What are the options? Picking up on what our German colleague was doing, he was going into some detail about particular kinds of relationships, bilateral and otherwise, that we might go into, and Graham will go through that. But I think probably worth saying before we go on to that, although I remarked earlier that the money that used to go as part of the subscription is now contestable, we really do need to continue to make the case that the levels of funding in R&D research science in the UK really do need to be maintained, increased. Perhaps the mood music around government, the noises are positive in that, but very much we would not want to see the money that came back over the wire disappear outside investment in R&D. So I will stop there, and Graham will now tell us how we should organize the world.